Hi, boys and girls. Like you, Santa is listening to the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com.
Merry Christmas, greetings, and welcome to another episode of the Merry Little Podcast of MyMerryChristmas.com. My name is Jeff Westover, and I am the lead stocking hanger at the Merry Forums of My Merry Christmas, where we are in our 29th year of celebrating Christmas together. This episode of the Merry Little Podcast is sponsored by ChristmasPodcasts.com, a place where you can find a repository of all kinds of Christmas podcasts year-round. It's also where you can hear the Christmas Podcast Podcast, a timely review of new episodes and features with Christmas podcasters from all over. We continue in this episode with our exploration of the Victorian Christmas. In preparing for what you are about to hear, I would tell you, in all candor, this is one of the most important episodes of the Merry Little Podcast that we have ever produced. The three previous episodes have labored to explain what Christmas was really like previous to the Civil War years. Now we're going to get into the war years and all that they meant for Christmas. This episode might go a little long in trying to explain it all. These were critical years that cannot be glossed over. They are important to understand both the history of Christmas and the years of the Victorian Christmas that followed.
From out the frozen Northland to the better-tempered clime, there's a train that comes a-rolling every year at Christmas time. All the kids are in the glory when the snow begins to fall, 'cause they know it's bringing Santa Claus and the Christmas cannonball. It takes off at the North Pole with a jingle and a roar. It's partly run by reindeer till it gets to Baltimore. If you hear the cry of timber coming out of Montreal, you can start to look for Santa Claus and the Christmas cannonball. Oh, the Christmas cannonball, the Christmas cannonball. Ting-a-ling-ling, toot-toot, ting-a-ling, toot, the Christmas cannonball. Nice things, mama dolls and fancy toys, but he picks out all the best things for the real good girls and boys. Then he hollers Merry Christmas, everybody big and small, 'cause he means make way for Santa Claus and the Christmas cannonball. So listen to your mother, do the things she tells you to. If you can't be good till Christmas, then it's just too bad for you. Take it easy with you crying and be careful one and all, 'cause it's almost time for Santa Claus and the Christmas cannonball. Oh, the Christmas cannonball, the Christmas cannonball. Jing-a-ling-ling, toot-toot, jing-a-ling, toot, the Christmas cannonball. Christmas cannonball, the Christmas cannonball, the Christmas cannonball.
Few innovations changed life in the 19th century like the railroads. It fueled the Industrial Revolution as tracks were built and trains started to roll as early as 1820. As their use spread over the decades, everything from transporting people to getting product from budding industries quickly evolved. The railroads simply changed lives. It changed the war, too. The North had the advantage with more than 20,000 miles of track when the war began. The South had less than half that. So much of the war was fought along supply lines, so railroads were a major target. But the war was also a very important trigger in teaching people the advantages of high-speed transportation. Union soldiers especially were affected by the experience. The government sent troops by rail even if the trains didn't have passenger cars to hold them. Many wrote in journals of hopping on trains to ride in boxcars and on platform trains, even on top of passenger cars if needed. Their instructions were to just get on the train in any way that they could. For most soldiers, train travel was a new experience entirely, and it was a real eye-opener. To get hundreds or even thousands of miles away in a matter of days without having to march or to take animals was big news. It would be important as well to note that women quickly learned the advantages of train travel as well during the Civil War. As troops moved to the various fields of battle, so too did all of their support units, which included medical units and even hospital trains. Records surviving from the time of what women thought of this form of travel are no less effusive in what they thought of it all. For as long as the war wore on, it was clear that those on all sides who participated in it learned that rail travel was the future. For those who celebrated Christmas in both the North and the South, rails would change nearly everything about their celebration, and it would become a hallmark of Christmas in American history as train travel became embedded into the American culture for the next 50 years and beyond after the Civil War, when it would first be challenged later by the automobile. For more than a century, trains were the centerpiece of mass transportation. The real connection of trains to Christmas was born of the fact that going over the river and through the woods to grandmother's house for the holidays was best accomplished by trains, and it happened every Christmas. In fact, more people moved by train in November and December over the course of those 100 years than by any other method. If you wanted to be home for Christmas, you simply had to take the train. This was a very important fact of Christmas life in the era of the Victorian Christmas. Historians and others note the importance of family during the celebrations of Christmas during this time frame. It was very real. In the episode of the Merry Little Podcast titled Christmas in Crisis, we talk about this in depth relative to the Civil War. We share several excerpts from journals of soldiers serving far from home during those Christmases of the war. In many ways, what they wrote during the Civil War would be like the sentiments sent home later during World Wars I and II. For example, soldier Samuel Bradley of the Massachusetts 10th Artillery wrote at Christmas 1864 to his wife, quote, "Just 4 short years ago tonight, you and I solemnly plighted our faith to each other for so long as we both should live. You, my darling, are now far, far away from me in our northern home. How swiftly memory brought back the last Christmas holiday and contrasted it with this. It seemed as if I could almost hear the Christmas chimes," unquote. The thing to remember about the American Civil War was that people at the time had never seen anything like it, and none of their grandparents had either. It had been 80 years since the American Revolution, and everyone on all sides of the war thought, well, it would be over quickly. They were wrong. The Civil War was simply the most brutal war on record ever. It was fought in the fields of families. It was fought between families, North and South. While desertions plagued both sides, the personal valor and the enormous casualties, both in absolute numbers and in percentage of numbers engaged, have not yet ceased to astound scholars and military historians. On the basis of the 3-year standard of enlistment, about 1.5 million soldiers served in the federal armies, and about 800,000 men probably served in Confederate forces, though spotty records make it impossible to know for sure. Traditionally, historians have put war deaths at about 360,000 for the Union and 260,000 for the Confederates. In the second decade of the 21st century, however, a demographer used better data and more sophisticated tools to convincingly revise the total death word upwards to 752,000 and indicated that it could be as high as 850,000. The enormous death rate, roughly 2% of the 1860 population of the United States, died in the Civil War, and that had an enormous impact on American society. Americans were deeply religious, and they struggled to understand how a benevolent God could allow such destruction to go on for so long. Understanding the nature of the afterlife shifted as Americans, North and South, confronted themselves with the notion that heaven, well, looked like their front parlors, a new mode of dealing with corpses also emerged with the advent of embalming, an expensive method of preservation that helped wealthier families to bring their dead sons, brothers, or fathers home. And finally, a network of federal military cemeteries and private Confederate cemeteries grew out of the need to bury the men in uniform who had succumbed to wounds or disease. Some have called the American Civil War the last of the old-fashioned wars. Others have termed it the first modern war. Actually, it was a transitional war, and it had a profound impact, technologically, on the development of modern weapons and techniques. There were so many innovations. It was the first war in history in which ironclad warships clashed. The first in which the telegraph and the railroad played significant roles. The first to use extensively rifled ordnance and shell guns and to introduce a machine gun known as the Gatling gun. The first to have widespread newspaper coverage, voting by servicemen in the field in national elections and photographic recordings of it all. The first to organize medical care of troops systematically and the first to use land and water mines to employ a submarine that could sink a warship. It was also the first war in which armies widely employed aerial reconnaissance by means of balloons. In many ways, the technological advances brought forward during the war were a predictor of how industry and society would quickly advance after the war. As the war came to a close in 1865, the rush to get home then was on, and it filled the trains. Life and Christmas, after all, had been severely interrupted, and people wanted to get back to it. The Civil War also signaled, as most wars do, a coming shift and an expansion of regular life in the years ahead. And few expansions were as prolific as post-Civil War America. This was also fueled by the advances in technology that we talked about as part of the war. Everything in technology, travel, and even conveniences of everyday living changed and were changing, and Christmas got caught up in it. Before the war, Christmas was very much a homemade kind of thing. Oh, you can find things in stores, but gifts were homemade, decorations were homemade, foods were homemade, and all that changed almost immediately after the war. In-store advertisements from 1865 to 1875, you can see the new things at Christmas that were coming out every single season. Singer sewing machines, for example, were offered in greater varieties and shifted from being advertised as commercial-grade appliances for tailors to being a must-have Christmas gift for the homemaker. For as much as this portends to changes in all things Christmas during the post-war period, it would be worthy of note to explore how and why Christmas changed in perception due to the war. And to do that, we need to explore two key individuals.
Upon a February morn, a tiny baby boy was born, Abraham. Abraham. When he grew up, this tiny babe, folks all called him Honest Abe. Abraham. Abraham. In 1860, he became the 16th president. And now he's in the Hall of Fame, a most respected gent. That's why we celebrate this blessed February day. Abraham. Abraham.
If there is one person in American history well documented and explored, it's Abraham Lincoln. For me, the book Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin and another titled A. Lincoln, A Biography, written in 2009 by Ronald White, are the best ones available. But when the topic of Christmas comes up in relation to Lincoln, most historians are frankly dismissive. And I get entirely why they would be. Lincoln was a fascinating person and a complex individual who had a far reach for all that he did as president and as a person. But it is exactly this dismissiveness that causes Christmas in the life of Lincoln and in the history of Christmas to be overlooked. Even among Christmas fans, the Christmas contributions of Abraham Lincoln are not obvious, or they're unknown, or they're just unacknowledged. We would like to change that. In fact, I declare in all seriousness that beyond Charles Dickens, there is not another real-life human being more influential in Christmas history than Abraham Lincoln during the era of the Victorian Christmas. His name should be nominated and enshrined in the Christmas Hall of Fame. How can I make such a declarative statement? After all, Lincoln, as a state legislator, actually voted against making Christmas a state holiday in Illinois long before he became president. He's noted for not having a Christmas tree in his White House, and he said little on the topic of Christmas while he was president. To many historians, Christmas was not even much of a footnote in the life of Abraham Lincoln. I think the mistake historians make is that if Christmas isn't a central theme in the life of an individual, it isn't a thing at all. And it is true, Christmas was not a central theme to Abraham Lincoln on a personal level. But Lincoln was smart enough to realize that Christmas was a central theme to nearly every generation of his time. As president, Lincoln listened to that. He used it, in fact. He acknowledged it, despite the fact that he wasn't much of a Christmas observer himself. As the argument is clearly made in Team of Rivals, if Lincoln was anything, he was a master of knowing the thinking of others. He greatly used it to his advantage, and that, my friends, is exactly why Christmas and Abraham Lincoln go together well. Taking everything you know about the Victorian Christmas from the last three episodes in this series of podcasts, I want you to consider the following about Abraham Lincoln that historians clearly know about him, but actually dismiss as nothing. First and foremost would be the fact that Abraham Lincoln was a spiritual man. This is actually a hotly debated topic among historians, and it stems from one simple fact of history. Every U.S. president has been a member of a church, except for Abraham Lincoln. This fact is twisted frequently to paint Lincoln out to either be an agnostic or an atheist. This debate will never die, because there are those whose agendas are so narrow that they need Lincoln, the greatest of all presidents, to be a non-believer. In my view, that will never happen, and it cannot happen. First of all, you cannot read the considerable and eloquent works and words of Lincoln and leave of the opinion that he did not believe in God. You just can't. Second of all, you have to realize that Lincoln suffered great tragedy during the Civil War years alongside everyone else. At 5 p.m. on February 20th, 1862, William Wallace Lincoln, the 11-year-old son of Abraham and Mary, died. Elizabeth Keckley, the former slave who designed Mrs. Lincoln's beautiful wardrobe, washed and dressed him. When the president gazed at him, he mourned, quote, "My poor boy, he was too good for this earth. God has called him home. I know that he is much better off in heaven, but then we loved him so. It is hard, hard to have him die," unquote. This oft-quoted sentiment doesn't begin to explain the grief and the suffering in the Lincoln home, especially with Mrs. Lincoln, who would in time become famous for having spiritual readings with a psychic of the time in order to reach out to her kindred dead. It was actually a very popular thing during the Civil War years because so many people were dealing with death. Both Mr. and Mrs. Lincoln were well acquainted with grief and faith. But it is true, Lincoln had no official church, but he was undeniably very spiritual. It's also notable that historians focus on Lincoln and Christmas mostly during just his years in the White House, which were all war years. For these scant experiences, or from these experiences, historians say the Lincolns didn't do much for Christmas. The Lincoln White House was notoriously chaotic and very public because of the war. It's also true that before his years in the White House, Lincoln didn't do much unique celebrating at Christmas either. This, too, leads historians to wrongly conclude that Christmas wasn't a thing at all to him. But, as another president, John Adams, said, facts are stubborn things. Let's go through a few of them. First to note in the life of Abraham Lincoln is that he was born in 1809, as we all knew, in a one-room log cabin in rural Kentucky. What is not well known is that his mother died when Lincoln was about 9 years old, and from that point forward, a major influence in his life was his 11-year-old sister Sarah, who was left in charge of the household until a stepmother entered into his life with 3 other children of her own. Lincoln came to love this stepmother of his, who understood his lack of desire to work on the farm and his inherent love of books, a habit that she encouraged in young Abraham. Lincoln rose above his station to educate himself, famously reading books while on the back of a horse. He became a lawyer. He had a couple of failed relationships, but eventually he settled down to married life that brought him a family of 4 sons and a very busy life in politics and business. His experience with Christmas was typical of most folks on the frontier. If they had a church, they knew about and celebrated Christmas. In the family life of Abraham Lincoln, there simply wasn't a church, and he was far from the centers of celebrated Christmas customs. Historians do note, however, that the Lincolns were typical of those who celebrated Christmas in the 1840s. The National Park Service, on their website, acknowledges that boughs of holly and mistletoe were brought into the home to decorate mantles and pictures. Lincoln family biographer Ruth Painter Randall's 1955 book titled Lincoln's Sons tells of the Lincolns hanging Christmas stockings. They say as well that gift-giving at Christmas had long happened in the Lincoln home. Adults often gave each other books, notepaper, pens, and fancy perfumes and soaps. Mr. Lincoln was recorded in the store register of John Williams and Company as buying 4 linen handkerchiefs, 3 gentlemen's silk handkerchiefs, and 4 children's silk handkerchiefs on December 24, 1860, along with some clothes and materials of linens for his wife. Being political, the holiday season meant parties, and the Lincolns both hosted and attended their share of Christmas events in the 1840s and 50s. As president, everything Lincoln did was noted, even at Christmas. Every Christmas during Lincoln's term was during a period of war. Christmas was therefore low-key, a workday, and an occasion that focused on the war effort. In Lincoln's first White House Christmas in 1861, much of December 25th was spent dealing with the diplomatic crisis with England and France. The evening, however, was spent in celebration of Christmas, as the Lincolns welcomed many family and friends from Illinois and Kentucky at a Christmas dinner. On Christmas afternoon in 1862, President and Mrs. Lincoln visited many hospitals to meet sick and wounded soldiers. The next year, 10-year-old Tad Lincoln, the president's youngest son, sent many soldiers gifts of books and clothing with the simple tag that said, "From Tad Lincoln." The last Christmas Eve of Lincoln's life in 1864 brought much-needed good news. Fresh off his successful march to the sea, General Sherman famously telegraphed to Lincoln, quote, "I beg to present to you a Christmas gift, the city of Savannah, with 150 heavy guns and plenty of ammunition, and also about 25,000 bales of cotton," unquote. 2 days later, Lincoln hosted a Christmas reception at the White House and also took time to write back to Sherman, expressing, quote, "many, many thanks for your Christmas gift, the capture of Savannah," unquote. All of these things seem quite normal for the Christmas celebration in the life of any sitting president. But these are not the things that make Abraham Lincoln's contribution to Christmas special. To make a big contribution, Lincoln needed to make use of the talents of one man in particular. His name was Thomas Nast. Thomas Nast did not invent Santa Claus. We should be able to say that myth is busted on the strength of just the past few episodes of the Merry Little Podcast. But if you study Thomas Nast aside from everything else going on with Christmas in the 19th century, That's exactly where historians are going to lead you. Even some are the same historians who tell you out the other side of their mouth that Charles Dickens invented Christmas. That's absurd, and don't you believe it. The real story of Thomas Nast and Christmas is far more interesting than to just sum it up by saying he drew some really cool pictures of Santa Claus. One member of the Merry Forums I was discussing this with, who is a professional Santa Claus, had studied some stuff about Thomas Nast and said that he felt that Thomas Nast was the 19th century equivalent to Norman Rockwell. That's an interesting idea, especially since Rockwell came along just a generation or two after Nast, and we'll get to Rockwell in a future episode of the Merry Little Podcast. The story of Thomas Nast is a little more interesting, however, if for one fact alone, he was German. Well, actually, he immigrated to America with his parents when he was a child of about 6 years old. He landed in New York City, the very birthplace of the modern Santa Claus. He grew up in the 1840s and 1850s at a time when the legend of Santa Claus was everywhere every year. As Smithsonian Magazine points out in one of the few details about Nast that they don't overstate, Thomas Nast was just the right man for the right job at exactly the right time. He was born in 1840, which made him much younger than Abraham Lincoln when they knew each other. But know each other they did, and they were very compatible. Now, I get some heat from some critics on this. I wrote years ago in a feature for My Merry Christmas about Lincoln and Christmas, stating that Lincoln had commissioned Nast to show Santa as a Union sympathizer for a piece he did for Harper's Weekly. This was not something that I invented. It was a story that came out in a history book dating from the early 20th century. Is it a true story? Well, there's no reason not to believe it, frankly. Nast was just 15 years old when he got a beat on a job with Leslie's Illustrated newspaper. The owner of the paper, seeing that he was just a kid, sent him off to make a sketch of people in a park. When Nast returned, the owner was stunned by what he had produced, and he hired him on the spot. His talent and ability with art was prodigious. Lincoln saw that too right away. At just 20 years of age, Nast went to England to cover an event, and when he came back to the United States, it was embroiled in the American Civil War, and Lincoln was in office as president. Young Nast got married, and by 1862, he was working as a political cartoonist for the very famous Harper's Weekly. Nast was an ardent Republican and a staunch supporter of Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln loved Nast too, calling him the, quote, best recruiting sergeant for the Union cause, unquote. Christmas of 1863 saw the Union effort bearing down hard on the South with a blockade of goods. For months on end, supplies were thin in the South as Lincoln strategized to squeeze the energy from the Confederate effort. The scarcity of goods and the high prices of store-bought items caused Southern mothers to explain to their children that not even Santa Claus could break the Union blockade. One famous letter to Lincoln from a Southern mother begged him to let Santa through. Lincoln instructed Nast to show Santa with Union troops as much as possible, and the enduring images from 1863 and 1864 publications are largely credited with defining the image of the modern Santa Claus. One of Thomas Nast's most famous prints was called The Union Christmas, which depicts President Lincoln standing at a door with him offering the cold and frostbitten Southern soldiers an invitation to rejoin the Union. Another Nast creation from earlier that same month showed the Confederacy's President Jefferson Davis and his problematic predicament. The illustration, entitled Lincoln's Christmas Box to Jeff Davis, showed the choices the South's leader by then had. It questioned more war or peace and union. Lincoln very clearly used Christmas, everyone was experiencing, to communicate that the war did not have to go on. These interwoven bits of art, history, culture, and military strategy show an American culture fully engaged in the celebration of Christmas, and President Abraham Lincoln was squarely in the middle of it all. What Lincoln accomplished through Thomas Nast was communication to the people of the South especially that he could not otherwise reach. Lincoln's vision for reunification was not one of punishment, but one of forgiveness and healing. Speaking to them through the heartfelt sentiment of Christmas was a natural part of that effort. Remember all that we've talked about in these episodes of Victorian Christmas. The Civil War brought all the emotion of home and family and love of Christmas to a fever pitch. The Christmas trees, the Christmas stockings, the Christmas music, the love of the Magi and the Nativity, the Christmas cards, the works of Charles Dickens, Clement Clark Moore, and Henry Wadsworth Longfellow all took deeper meaning because of the war. Over the many episodes of the Merry Little Podcast, we have talked about certain pivotal years of Christmas. Christmases of 1776, 1941, and 1968 are examples of such years. 1863 is another one of those years. In fact, it may be the most important year of Christmas in American history. In researching this episode, the year of 1863 stands out in the journals and letters of the time. If ever there was a wartime Christmas where peace was prayed for, it was in 1863. Folks were just plain desperate, including Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. 1863 was the year of his anxious walk on Christmas morning. He had already suffered the death of his wife, and now he faced the grim injury with his soldier son. Somehow, in the midst of those trials, he managed to voice what nearly everyone was feeling. For those in the field, it was another Christmas out in the cold, wrote one soldier, quote, "And so this is war," my old me said to himself while he paced in the snow his 2 hours on the river's brink, "and I'm out here to shoot that lean, lank, coughing, cadaverous-looking butternut fellow over the river. So this is war. This is being a soldier. This is the genuine article. This is Horace Greeley's On to Richmond. Well, I wish he were here in my place, running to keep warm, pounding his arms and breast to make the chilled blood circulate. So this is war, tramping up and down this river, my 50 yards with wet feet, empty stomach, and swollen nose, unquote. A little further south in Chattanooga, Tennessee, Thomas Hook McCallie, a pastor of a local Presbyterian church, recorded this, quote, "I shall never forget the Christmas of 1863. All without was winter. Horrid war had desolated everything. Our church was used for a hospital, and no bell rang out on the air telling us of God, His house, His worship. There was no Sunday school. There was no day school. The churches were closed, the pastors all, except myself, gone. The old citizens had gone south or had been sent north. Only a few families remained, and they were, and frequently, saw each other. There were no stores open, no markets of any kind, no carriages on the streets, no civil officers, no taxes, nor tax collectors, fortunately. Strangers filled our streets, our highways, and our houses. The rattle of spurs of officers and the tramp of the soldiers was constantly falling on the air. It was winter in the home except for a few precious rays of sunshine. We had no milk, no butter, no cheese, scarcely any fruit, but bacon, bread, such as we could make without milk or yeast, coffee, sugar, and a barrel of pickles in the brine, but no vinegar to put them in. The rays of sunshine were good health, powerful divine protection, keeping us in peace where so many were being sent away from their home, and a sense of God's forgiveness and gracious watch care over us," unquote. Well, for years now here at the Merry Little Podcast, we've collected quotes from letters and journals of these Civil War years. There are groups on social media dedicated to sharing these letters from those years. In reviewing our entire collection for this episode, it dawned on me that the year of 1863 is when things were so very, very desperate for nearly everyone on all sides of the war. Lincoln knew it. He also knew and understood how Thanksgiving played into it all. He did not need to make the celebration of Thanksgiving a national act. It is interesting to note when his action on Thanksgiving actually happened. It didn't occur the first year of the war, and it didn't occur at the end of the war. It happened after its very worst battles, after Gettysburg of 1863. Sarah Josepha Hale had written to Lincoln on September 28, 1863. Her plea was much as it had been for the previous 15 years, regardless of who was president. But this time, her letter was met by listening ears, ears that had heard the pleas of Hale already the previous 2 years. It fell on ears of a president who had endured the most trying year of the war, of his generals letting him down, of his many visits to field hospitals, to the maimed and the near dead. It was the years of his most gut-wrenching letters from both the North and the South. What was different this time? Well, if you recall, the bloody battle of Gettysburg was fought in July, just weeks before Hale sent her letter. It was an event that had a profound effect on Lincoln, and it proved to be the turning point of the entire war, though he probably didn't know that at a time. Less than a week after he received her letter, Lincoln acted boldly and quickly. He said, in a passage rarely quoted anymore in talking about Christmas or Thanksgiving, quote, "In the midst of a civil war of unequaled magnitude and severity, which has sometimes seemed to foreign states to invite and to provoke their aggression, peace has been preserved with all nations. Order has been maintained. The laws have been respected and obeyed, and harmony has prevailed everywhere except in the theater of military conflict. While that theater has been greatly contracted by the advancing armies and navies of the Union, needful diversions of wealth and of strength from the fields of peaceful industry to the national defense have not arrested the plow, the shuttle, or the ship. The axe has enlarged the borders of our settlements, and the mines, as well of iron and coal as of the precious metals, have yielded even more abundantly than heretofore. Population has steadily increased, notwithstanding the waste that has been made in the camp, the siege, and the battlefield. And the country, rejoicing in the consciousness of augmented strength and vigor, is permitted to expect continuance of years with large increase of freedom. No human counsel hath devised, nor hath any mortal hand worked out these great things. They are the gracious gifts of the Most High God, who, while dealing with us in anger for our sins, hath nevertheless remembered mercy." Unquote. And with that, he declared the fourth Thursday of November would be Thanksgiving for the entire United States. But before that Thanksgiving Day would arrive, Lincoln would have to give one more important speech, the Gettysburg Address. For that speech, Lincoln went to Gettysburg and witnessed there, 4 full months after the battle, the devastation of the loss of so much human life. He was, with the others gathered, there to dedicate the cemetery. He was speaking to the heart of the conflict at a time when he was declaring to the nation that together they would pray in gratitude to God. Which is more important, or thought of, by celebrants of Christmas and Thanksgiving in that season of 1863? Was it the war, or was it the redemption that comes by embracing God and forgiving others that comes through Christmas? Wasn't that what Christmas was all about? Perhaps the words of Lincoln in Gettysburg himself tell us what they were all thinking. Quote, "The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." Unquote. Of our Civil War history centers on the generals involved and the strategies that they employed. To their monuments and the things written of in books, we must continue to take notice. But the effect on the heart and soul of Americans of every kind, the Yankees to the north, the rebels to the south, the slaves they held everywhere, that's what needs our attention. It certainly and plainly is reflected in the letters, journals, art, and history of that time of Christmas 1863. It was 1863 when Nast published Santa Wearing the Stars and Stripes and handing out gifts to Union soldiers. But to open that issue of Harper's Weekly, there was another famous Christmas work of art that Nash shows Santa Claus in the second drawing, this time in a more traditional Christmas sense. Titled Christmas Eve, the double circle picture shows a woman kneeling at the foot of her children's bed as she prays for the safety of her husband, who appears in the next circle, sitting alone in front of a fire, wistfully looking at the photographs of his family. In the upper left corner of the drawing on the periphery, Santa Claus is shown climbing down a chimney. In the upper right, he's shown distributing gifts as he rides a sleigh being pulled by reindeer. It's a striking and a sobering and a festive image, if you can believe that. Unlike what most historians will tell you, Nast was not showing Americans anywhere anything new about Christmas and Santa Claus in 1863. He was showing America a mirror, and he was speaking to their hearts, just like Norman Rockwell would do during the Great Depression, and just as Irving Berlin and Bing Crosby would later do with White Christmas. Nast, at the end of the day, was a reporter and a communicator. Lincoln knew this, and he exploited it. He knew intimately what people were experiencing at Christmas of 1863. Nast was not only happy to play along, he was anxious to continue the tradition Christmas after Christmas for years to come. His next drawing featured the same couple happily reunited as the husband returns home on furlough. In a panel to the left, Santa Claus is seen stepping from the fireplace with a sack on his back as the children sleep soundly on Christmas Eve. The following Christmas drawing showed a demilitarized Santa smoking a pipe and wishing a Merry Christmas to all. Long after the war, long after the assassination of President Lincoln, Nast continued to refine the American Santa that he had envisioned. He continued under the influence of both his German upbringing and the current events of Christmas in America. Historians never tell it this way, though. The way they tell the story, they credit the likes of Dickens and Nast as inventors, and they weren't. They were artists who celebrated Christmas alongside their contemporaries, and their works leave us with the treasure of what Christmas was like at that time. Sunday was found in a school for African-American children in Kentucky shortly after the Civil War. It was even then an old song that was intended to teach children the nativity story, and thus it has gone down in history as a Christmas song. But the song itself is emblematic of the entire Christmas picture in America after the Civil War. Everyone knew the world was different, but how did they adjust to their new realities? That story, as we all know, was written for generations after the war. I have learned some of this from researching my own family history, and I would encourage anyone who has family records available to them to do the same. Just as we know what a game changer was for families with World War II, the Civil War had a long-lasting effect on American families from all over. The war sent people to new areas, and some people just stayed there, never to return to the life or the place that they knew before. Some did that because they weren't sure that the home that they had existed anymore, or they were told it no longer existed. Some were affected mentally, not sure if they could cope with what they would return home to, or if they could escape the horrors that they had been shown. In my mother's family, all Yankees from Western New York in the 1850s, many of the men served in the war and fought at places like Gettysburg. It's interesting to note what happened within those branches of the family who served, where there was no history of things like alcohol abuse and suicide. A whole generation of war vets started that struggle in the 1860s and 1870s, and it would affect later generations in big ways. Those complexities in a wounded America were healed in some respects by Christmas. The story of Christmas after the war is not hard to see or explain. Nearly all Americans loved Christmas and wanted more of it. The forgiveness and the healing they sought was found and celebrated in it. Christmas expanded as industries recovered, expanded, and grew in technology. As they went, so too did the technology of Christmas. An article from the New York Post in 1879 describes the Christmas tree of the time, which they admitted were common to most American homes. Gifts were placed on the tree in those days, but not really by Santa Claus. Santa's gifts went inside stockings for the most part. But the tree was the gift exchange center of the time. It was a place where family members and friends placed their gifts, which were usually very modest and very personal in nature. On Christmas Eve, the gifts went on the tree. On Christmas morning, they were opened. The advent of Christmas lights happened in the early 1880s, but that doesn't mean that folks had them. Those stories of the first lights were fraught with tales of just getting electricity first and hardwiring each individual light. But as America recovered, and as Christmas went on, even to the point of finally being declared officially what it already was since the beginning, it began to change in many, many ways. Coming up in episode number 5 of the Victorian Christmas, we explore the expanding world of Christmas decorations of the period, as well as more on the pioneering retailers of Christmas. And we get one more time a surprising element of Christmas almost nobody ever talks about from the Victorian era. It is a favorite topic here on the Merry Little Podcast. It was pumpkin, and the Christmas of the 19th century was full of it. Join us at the Merry Forums of MyMerryChristmas.com, where we celebrate and share Christmas of all times and seasons every day of the year. For My Merry Christmas, this is Jeff Westover wishing you and yours a very Merry Christmas.